All right, welcome back to another episode of Mistakes, Missteps, and Mindsets, stories of failure and resilience in academia. My name is Alex White, and I'm here with my co-host today,
Dr. Crystal Nunes.
Today, we are here with Dr. Brian Koivisto. He is an associate professor in the Department of Chemistry and Biology here at Toronto Metropolitan University. His research investigates the utility of organic dyes for harvesting light in dye-sensitized solar cells. Prior to joining TMU in 2012, Dr. Koivisto worked with the Institute for Sustainable Energy, Environment, and Economy at the University of Calgary and held an NSERC PDF position at the University of Edinburgh. Welcome to the podcast, Brian.
Crystal, Alex, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast. So we wanted to begin with an overview of your research. Can you describe for our listeners your current research interests and what projects you have underway in your research group?
Sure. I should have asked who your listeners were first to get it right. So I am an organic materials chemist, which means I don't work with medicinal chemistry so much and drug discovery, but more focused on making new materials with certain properties that can do certain things. So as mentioned in the intro, I work with photovoltaics. So that's like solar cells. So we make organic-based materials that can harvest the sun's energy and create it into electricity. Ideally now, that's the very high level. Specifically, I guess we deal with polymers or plastics. Ideally, we're working with organic things that are also truly sustainable, because carbon, of course, is something you can get to scale that can power the world. And it's very bio-inspired. So we try to look at things that nature does really well and then try to replicate those things in what we do. Replicate's the wrong word, mimic, because replication would be a much harder task.
Fair enough.
What we want to do, though, is to create the tools that people can use. The sun is the only free source of energy this planet gets.
Absolutely.
It's the only extraterrestrial thing that we get that we can take advantage of. So that's really our focus.
And how did you get here? So could you briefly describe for us your academic journey?
Yeah, I think and it comes back to my research. I think largely, so I grew up on a farm in Northern Ontario, which is a very unique mindset, because a lot of people came from cities, at least the people that I teach. So that has really informed the way that I see the world and how I want to interact with the world. So I'm not saying that farming is perfect, but it does rely heavily on Mother Earth to provide, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what our research does too, largely with a little bit of an assist. So I started there. I then went to the University of Waterloo for my undergrad. I was not a good student, but I suspect we'll circle back to that.
Yep.
But I loved chemistry. Like, I absolutely loved it. So we'll come back to that too. Anyway, so then I didn't know what I was going to do. I was in the co-op program. I had some good jobs and some bad ones. And then I met somebody, for an older student than me, who said he was going to go to grad school. And I was like, oh, that sounds fun. I'll go to a grad school too. And ended up going to Victoria, where I did my PhD, the University of Victoria. Graduated, had a great experience there. Victoria's a great city, by the way. And then I went to Edinburgh, Scotland for 2 years. That was a very big eye-opener, because that was me first living abroad and having to integrate into another system. And you really start to see the values that your country holds dear, but also, you know, where we come up short, right? Especially when it's another Western-based country that has wonderful social programs. And then there were no jobs in the market in 2008, because there was a big crash. I don't know if anybody remembers that, or maybe you're too young on this audio podcast. But yeah, so then I did a second postdoc at Calgary, which was another eye-opening experience, because it was almost as different for me as going to Edinburgh, quite honestly. And then it was a fantastic experience, and wonderful people along the way. And I think that's what I mean when I say experiences. It's the people that you meet that inspire you, right? And that's what makes the experience so amazing. The chemistry, well, it is all chemistry, I guess, right? As I'm smiling and I say that, that's a pun, in case you I won't explain it.
But
yeah. Anyway, so then got the job at Ryerson at the time, Toronto Metropolitan University, in 2011, been here ever since.
It's interesting that your decision to pursue graduate school was inspired by a connection with a student older than you. We've had several individuals on the podcast who have mentioned that it was an early research opportunity given by a faculty member that inspired that, which is, of course, incredibly valuable. But you're also highlighting then the importance of providing opportunities to meet or network with older students. I certainly didn't do that in my own undergraduate education. I was kind of more interacting with just those in my year, but that could be really valuable as well. Mm-hmm. Having those upper year students come in speaking to those still trying to figure out their journeys.
Yeah, I think the near peer is more influential, right?
Like, sure.
Because you can see yourself being them.
Exactly.
And it's very easy to do. And yeah.
So you come from small town, Northern Ontario.
RR number two. There's no town.
My mistake. Yeah. RR number two. Did you always then imagine yourself being a tenured faculty member?
Nope. At no point in my undergrad did I see myself being a faculty member until something at the end. And then I thought, oh, teaching might be cool. Mm-hmm. So like I went to Waterloo because one of my great aunts, somebody who was very influential in my life, died of ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm going to go find the cure for cancer. And biochemistry was the program I entered into at Waterloo. It's not the program I graduated from. That really inspired me down that path. And then fortunately, and I think you can do this here at TMU, you can get the opportunity in your fourth year to be a TA.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So I TA'd in my fourth year.
Great.
And I loved it. Like, and there are some really funny stories that we don't have time to get into, but that the students did. But again, near peer, you're only 3 years older than those people you're right. TAing, and you can kind of coach them a little bit about what they can expect in their undergrad. So I think the value to the first year students is also great because now they're seeing somebody who doesn't look like some sort of omnipotent being in the classroom, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Also, like, we have the SLG leaders, and Valeria was one of the SLG leaders for biochem, and she was in your lab. And she was always like, oh, Brian this, Brian that. And everyone's like, who's Brian? And eventually she's like, oh, you guys don't know Brian? And everyone's like, no. All she said was positive things about you. And her talking about what you like do in your lab was kind of my thing where I was like, I could do Orgo too. That could be a fun course. Mm. Hey guys, editing Alex here. I just thought I should mention, for the sake of transparency and in the spirit of the podcast, that I am in fact no longer enrolled in organic chemistry 2. I do say in the episode that I am and I was, but I am not. I did have to drop it because I am taking the second half of physics 2 and I underestimated just how much work that would be. It has been a minute since I took physics 1 and I was a little rusty, but I had to kind of catch myself up, and I also had to do tutorials, and I also had to do labs, which means I also had to write lab reports. And so my journey with organic chemistry is on pause for the moment, but that does not mean that I will not come back to it. And if I don't come back to it, that's okay too. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoy the rest of the episode, and see you at the end.
Your reputation precedes you.
Yeah, you
clearly.
Come up a lot, awesome. Actually. You come up a lot in a good way, in a very good way.
Yeah, it's nice to have that impact. I'm not somebody who likes compliments.
Yeah.
And you'll know because I don't dish them out very often either. I roll with the way I like. But so it's a bit, like, I'll say it's a bit, it feels uncomfortable to me to hear right. that. But I'm glad. Like,
yeah.
I'm glad that that is the way people feel because that's obviously what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
And my journey to my current position is similar as well, in that I definitely did not consider this as a career path until probably relatively recently, maybe even a couple years out of my PhD. But it was the same drive of my interest in teaching, which makes sense based on my current position and how much I enjoyed working as a TA. Liking the research, but loving the TA work, and then diving head on into that following graduation, imagining a maybe more teaching focused role at a college level, but this is related and enjoyable as well.
Can I just add to that? I was going to say, like, I think at TMU too, at least most of the peers that I socialize with, my colleagues, I think they're all kind of like, the research is just a means to the end. Like, research is meant to serve humanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's about people. Indirect, and in science, you need graduate students and senior undergrads to let do those experiments. And so it's about people. And so just like you, it's always been about people. And it's great that I can explore curiosities and with people. And so it's about this journey with people that I think is the most important thing.
So one of the objectives of our podcast is to help humanize professors for our students. Maybe they'll tune into an episode, hear one of their professors for which they're taking a course, and create this environment or this platform we can share our experiences with failure, which is, of course, something that everyone can relate to. So with that in mind, can you tell us about a time when you failed? Whatever example you wish, from your undergrad, research, your time as a PI.
Yeah, I'm failing all the time. Great. I think it's humbling. It's humbling, but it's also the best learning experience. So coming back to the Waterloo days, I remember my first year, the first round of midterms that happened, and in my five courses, every single midterm had a different denominator, but every single midterm worked out to 57%.
Oh.
And I was every course, math, chemistry, biology, every single course.
You were consistent, if nothing else.
Very consistent. And I remember having, and this was my first time where I was like, I'm trying. And I'm not able to, like a lack of preparation from high school or whatever, or thinking you were confident from high school, right?
Right.
False confidence. And so, I think I remember maybe having a breakdown, or I don't know what you call it, but for the long weekend in Thanksgiving, I remember just sitting in my chair and staring out my window. And my parents had given me I was living in residence, a little gift basket, like a care package, and it had some apples in it. We grew apples on our farm too. So apples from home, and they were sitting in the windowsill because that would be the coldest spot. And so then there were lots of ducks at Waterloo campus. And so at some point I was broken from this trance of staring out into the quad by this tapping sound on the glass. And it was a duck trying to get the apples from the outside.
Right.
And I just laughed hysterically. And that's where I broke out of my funk. And I was like, at least I'm not a duck. And it was that moment where I was like, you know what? Okay, so what can I take to learn from these experiences and embrace failure?
Right.
Because it wasn't going to be although it felt like it was the worst first time, it probably wasn't. It was going to be a rough ride. But what was I there for? I was there to learn.
Yeah.
So I wasn't there for a job or a career or anything. I was there to learn.
Right.
And I wasn't there because my parents made me go, thankfully. Although they said that you were always going to go to university, they weren't forcing me to do anything.
Right.
So I think in those moments, that moment sort of let me let go. And if I was going to fail, I was going to learn something.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was going to be a learning lesson. And I did. Like the course I teach right now to Alex is the course I failed as an undergrad.
Really?
So, and the reason why I can teach these courses, I think, more effectively is because I understand what it's like not to get it. But I also understand what it's like to what I should focus on and what I shouldn't, because that was the learning message, right? Like I was trying to derive everything from first principles. You can't do that. Mm-mm. Like you got to commit some things to memory. And then there are things you must understand, and knowing what those two things are was really powerful in that discovery. And if I could, completely different anecdote, if I could just add to a more recent feeling of failure, but it was just a lack of communication. I was talking to one of my PhD students, and they approached me, and they were kind of frustrated. They had tears in their eyes, and they were like, I don't feel like you can support me the way that you previously had. Like I'm giving up on them somehow. We're entering into a part of our research where I don't have the answers anymore.
Mm.
Like I don't even have the experience in this field. So I'm a bit of an imposter in a way, learning like she is. And so I literally had to tell them, like, well, I'm sorry, I can only help guide you. I don't know this any better than you do. And I think that showing that vulnerability and that weakness gave her a lot of strength too, because when you get a PhD and you graduate with a PhD, you have to be my equal. Like you have to be like, or better, the besting me in one area and or something similar. And so I think that provided a lot of encouragement that she was becoming better than me at something, and I could no longer help her.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I think the failure to communicate that, but maybe not even really understanding it myself until we had that heart-to-heart moment, right?
Sure.
There's things we can't do where they're outside our scope, especially in research, because we've never dealt with those situations or this time period in life.
Yeah, I've looked through the slides for this class. It's interesting that you say that you failed this. He teaches organic chemistry, in case we didn't mention that. Because you truly like put everything you need to know there, and you don't really focus on all the like, you know, this is why this thing was discovered. Like, you go through it very briefly because it is important to know those things. So you're like, but this is what you need to know. So you recognize those traps and those pitfalls. And I really appreciate that as a student. I feel like a lot of the time slideshows are bungled with a bunch of stuff that we actually don't need to know and isn't necessarily the most integral part of the course, but you can get stuck on it. Especially me, I like to get stuck on irrelevant things all the time.
I think that's why I don't think there's an organic course in the country that I've talked to of any of my peers that does weekly quizzes as opposed to midterms. And that's why I do it.
Yeah.
Because it's very easy to you see lose the forest for the trees kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you don't know what I need to know. And I also don't want people asking that question, because that to me also says like, well, you don't really care about what I'm talking about. But by quizzing more frequently, lower stakes, more frequently, you won't fall in that trap of being like, oh, it looks so easy when somebody else does it. It makes perfect sense, right? So it allows the student to redistill and redistill and redistill.
Yeah, absolutely. And also being transparent about like, this is what you got wrong. This is how you would have gotten the right answer. That is so helpful too, because I feel like that's something we don't get a lot in our undergrad. Sometimes we can't even look at our exams or our tests. And so you kind of never know, but we've talked about it before on the podcast that revisiting those times when you haven't done well on something is actually the best way to learn. And I truly do appreciate that style. And I think a lot of students, if you're scared to take Orgo too, I mean, I'm saying this kind of early, but I think it's a good course to take. I think it kind of teaches you how to learn. It does teach you how to learn a little bit though. And I think that's a good thing, especially after, you know, being online for so long, which has kind of robbed people of their ability to,
100%.
Yeah.
Well, I think I said this in class just the other day, people aren't, what I've noticed, you're never, and it wouldn't matter what age you are, you're not ready to learn until you ask the question. So when you get your quiz back and you see a mistake, you're like, why did I get this wrong? That's a question.
Yeah.
You won't make that mistake anymore.
Yeah.
So I don't believe that people will not continue to make the same mistake. We see that all the time in life, but because they never question themselves.
Yeah.
And so that introspection is really important. So drawing people to ask questions will help them, I think, always get through that next problem.
I mean, Alex, as a former student of mine as well, you've heard me say this to the class time and time again, that if you get a question wrong, but you take the time to figure out why you were wrong, which is the correct answer, you are more likely to remember that concept on a later evaluation than if you just gave it a guess and you got lucky and you got the question right and you don't revisit it. So anytime we do questions in class, and if there are students who get it wrong, I tell them to also give themselves a little pat on the back, because now they're more likely to remember that concept. I was also going to say how valuable it is as an instructor or your approach to your organic chemistry course, because I think it's very easy for an individual who's an expert in that field and is so brilliant with that content to then have that disconnect and not realize where the foundational knowledge is for students and think, oh, you should understand this. This is simple. This is straightforward. And it's not that way for everyone who's still just trying to learn those concepts. But we've now identified in your journey, there was an influential upper year student and an influential duck thus far. So I'm curious to know what happened after that Thanksgiving weekend. Did things turn around?
Nope. No, so they got worse. But I was prepared for it emotionally because I wasn't, I kind of had that heart to heart with my parents about how tough it was. And like neither one of them had went to university, so they didn't know either, but they knew that I worked hard and I tried, and they understood that, okay, this is, and they when I graduated, they saw it as such an accomplishment that I had just, you know, edged my way into. Like, I didn't see it as such a big accomplishment. I was going to go to grad school afterwards. Like, it was just another step for me, but they were so proud. And I think I know why, because you don't ever get a chance to well, we take time sometimes to reflect, look back and say, wow, look what I've accomplished. But when you're in it, you won't really appreciate it as somebody right. who's an observer outside it. Mm-hmm. And they see how much you've changed or how much you've grown. So that helped a lot. Like they weren't upset with me. I was really concerned that they would be if I failed, because mm-hmm. that would have been my first time of failure, and failure was not something my parents endorsed. But I okay. think they understood that after, you know, having me talk to them about this, because it was the second year that I had failed. So the second semester of the second year.
Right.
So it was much later than that first year, but just for everybody knows, my cumulative average, so Waterloo, they just did averages, they didn't do letter grades, mm-hmm. was 63%. Wow. That was all courses integrated, that's how much, and I had one failed course on my transcript. So most people would say, what? Like, in fact, I couldn't get into grad school in Ontario. My grades weren't high enough.
Oh, wow.
I had to leave the province in order to have some sort of weird adjustment to a GPA scale that allowed me to do that. Mm-hmm. But there's there's a will, there's a way. So, and it's a good way. Like, don't ever think it's like plan B or plan C is a bad plan. They are all good plans if you are planning them up. But you know, sometimes we're better at certain things, and that's where life takes you.
I've had students reach out or apply to work in our research group, and in providing their transcript, they would have had quite low grades in first year, kind of going into second year. And I've had some students feel like they immediately need to explain or are showing kind of feelings of shame related to it. I don't mind that at all. I think first year is such a time, or even into second year, is such a time for learning and growth. And as long as I see that trajectory, I see that improvement in your grades, that to me is fantastic. You don't have to have that flawless transcript mm-hmm. to then engage in a research group or, in my opinion, get into research programs as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned that your family your parents did not embrace failure. But you also mentioned that they wanted you to go to university. So what was that like? Was it because you grew up on a farm? I'm assuming your parents worked on the farm.
So my dad always, so he didn't get the opportunity. Maybe he chose not to. I think back in the day, he probably could have afforded to go and all the rest, but he didn't finish grade 12. And my mom did some college work, but my dad knew the future job prospects and my well-being was going to be intimately linked to my ability to do math and sciences. Mm-hmm. So that was where the two were. I could fail gym, I could fail English, I could fail anything else, but in maths and sciences, I could not fail. Like it was said, like it wasn't just implied. And that they had to be a priority because that was when it was going to lead to a successful life, in his opinion. And mm-hmm. well, I don't necessarily agree with that now if I had my own kids, but certainly that wasn't a bad move to mm-hmm. instill the importance of those subjects to me.
Yeah. It's, I think we talk about parental pressure a lot.
Yep.
But it's very intense. Like I don't have it. I'm very fortunate, or maybe unfortunate depending on how you look at it. But I do see it with my peers a lot, and it's heartbreaking sometimes to see people doing things that they necessarily aren't interested in, but they have to do it.
Yeah.
But you were interested. You just weren't performing the way that you thought you would.
Yeah, I've been interested in everything. I've always been a super curious person about every single subject. Like mm-hmm. I find everything fascinating. So I wouldn't say specifically that was it, but this is my bias now, but I can, maybe sociologists would disagree, or psychologists even, although that would be arguably a science,
we might need to cut that part.
No, psychology is in, so what I'm getting at is psychology at TMU is in the arts faculty, but in many faculties across Canada, it is in the science faculty. And so my point in what I'm trying to say is that they may disagree about the importance of different subjects, mm-hmm. but I can't, mm-hmm. like, science does such a great job of explaining the natural world. And if you're interested in the natural world, which is where I came up, like agriculture, then it's going to tell you a lot. It's going to allow you to predict things. It's going mm-hmm. to allow you to experiment. And those things have always been a part of who I am. And so they really, really, I don't think anyone could disagree with the importance of those subjects.
Yeah.
So, that's what I was getting at. Not ripping into my colleagues. We have wonderful, they do some really cool stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
And very interdisciplinary stuff as well, too.
Yep.
Yeah,
I collaborate with a few faculty members in psychology as well, and it's really great, interesting work. Similarly, I also did not have parental pressure, mm-hmm. which overall I think was a benefit to me. I'm also a first generation student, first to go to university, but I see it in my students all the time. We've collected data on that as well, that it's one of the leading fears of failure is what their parents or guardians will think, which also highlights the importance of having that support system. And for some of us, it's our parents, but maybe for other students, they need to find that support elsewhere with their peers here at TMU, even us as their instructors.
Yeah, or hedge your bets too. Like, you could take some electives, you're allowed to, right? Like, take them in areas that you're interested in. See if your interests truly are where they think you think they are. While still appeasing your parents. The one thing I think that would really help that unfortunately our students don't get the opportunity to do is like living away from home, right? Parents responded very differently because I was no longer living at home, and when they did see me, they were like, "Oh, look how much he's matured," but you can see that we put him under a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think, again, similar to you don't see your own growth, if you come home every night and your parents see every day, they're not going to see it either, right? Yeah. So I think that that's a real challenge that I, again, that's the privilege that I had, to go away to university and not have my parents helicoptering over around me.
But I think it is valuable to explore those elective courses. Again, my major started as physical geography, science stream, and I ended up pursuing biology. And you mentioned your starting major in Waterloo was not where you ended
up. Biochemistry, yeah, it's pretty close, but a little different.
Yeah, fair enough. And Alex, you've also switched fields quite dramatically, I would say.
Yeah, I was at U of T for film and psych, and then I did a huge swerve into the sciences, and now I'm focusing on environmental biology. Probably going to do a master's in something related to that. We'll see. I was always like an art kid. I was the English kid. I was the drama. I did drama and dance, and my parents were like in film and theater. So I was never meant to be the science kid, and yet I am here today. I mean, I don't know if I'm the science kid even now, but
well, we have a grad student in the Ensignment program that, you know, environmental applied science and management program, indigenous background, and they're using film to document a lot of the environmental changes that are happening and explaining to people what's happening, right? So that, like, you know, the film and those two things are not opposites. They're just, one is a tool that can help the other tool, right?
Yes.
And I think that's the way to, the interconnectedness of all things are where all the cool discoveries are happening and all the cool creations. So I would say embrace it. The more things you can bring in from your previous life experience or that you can gather are going to be huge in influencing you going forward.
So you teach organic chemistry here at TMU, and regardless of the institution, organic chemistry tends to have a bit of a negative reputation. People seem to think it's very difficult, it's hard. This means often that students, when they do take your class, are entering into it. I know the chem students have to take it, it's required for them, but a lot of bio kids don't want to take it. How do you sort of battle that stigma of entering your classroom?
It is a really tough uphill battle. When your flight and fight and flight mechanism is engaged, how do I teach you? Like, that's not, one learns in those environments, right? Like, they might reflect afterward and be like, oh yeah, I'll dodge this thing next time, right? Like, but I'm aware of that. I wasn't fully aware of how hard it was until when I was the director of the Science Discovery Zone. I went to the Silicon Valley for some training when it was offered. Like, it was called Lean Launchpad. It's a business essentially community that was there, and the facilitators of the workshop, it's like, oh, and they're all university faculty members. Oh, you guys know what the killer course is, and everyone's like, oh yeah, and they're looking. Everyone, like 100 people in this room, are all like nodding their head and looking at them, and I have no idea what that is, and so they didn't say it was, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna put up my hand. What is the question? Oh, organic chemistry. I was like, what? Like, it's the only thing I've known, right? So it's my experience, it's my lived journey, and it's something I'm comfortable with. But I didn't know it was so scary for everybody. Like, if you go onto Google, it will be in the top three of the hardest courses under any university undergraduate or graduate program.
Right.
It'll be listed. And so I didn't know that. So I didn't know the extent to which it was hard. I obviously knew it was hard because I failed. So, but I didn't know that it was so overwhelming to people. Mm-hmm. So I get that. And I think that's why, again, these quizzes help me as much as they help the students too, right? Like, first of all, the reason why, one of the benefits of quizzes is I get to know everyone's names within 3 weeks, mm-hmm. right? Now you're not anonymous. So right. if you think that I don't remember that you failed your last quiz, well, I did. And I won't, you know, out you in public, but I will take you aside and be, well, you'll get the next one, right? There was some sort of comment like that. Because I think anonymity is a huge curse for students. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is I get to see, coming back to what you talked about, where the struggles are. So yes, yeah. I've done this a lot and I sound like a broken record from time to time. So what were the areas I didn't do a very good job on, or what isn't available? What are they struggling with? Let's revisit it. So we always try to keep it on the low stakes, mm-hmm. right? At every stage. Students don't understand that. Like, again, so coming back, so 10 quizzes, you drop your lowest two automatically. Mm-hmm. Everyone thinks of that as a bonus. It's a course management policy, which means I don't have to have any rewrites for my quizzes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And which is, so it's a pragmatic thing. It does work out for a bonus if you're there for 10 weeks. Right. But at the end of the day, like, it's, each thing is low stakes, and we're building. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine the final exam would be like stapling your quizzes together and writing them all at once.
Yeah.
So I think that helps lower people's anxiety to things. I think, you know, interesting anecdotes, because another thing too is when you're in that anxious moment of fight or flight, your curiosity goes out the window, mm-hmm. right? You don't pause to be like, that's interesting. What did he say? So there'll be weird things that I will say that have nothing to do with the course content. I'd probably lose my mind if anyone says, is this going to be on the exam? No one ever has as of yet. But this is why this should interest you. This is why this is important.
Yeah.
And reminding people. And I think that helps too, because then they see the reason for being there. Because mm-hmm. Often we lose scope with that too.
Yeah. Yeah, that curiosity, you're right. It does just... See ya. Like, I'm in physics 2 right now, and I'm totally in fight or flight at the moment. But the labs are really interesting, yeah. like getting to do all the experiments with the electrons and stuff. I love that. But as soon as I'm sitting in that lecture room, I'm like, I know this isn't going to go well. Yeah. I have to leave.
Well, and you can read the room. Like, mm-hmm. the nice thing too about when you know people's names is you hold eye contact a little bit longer. Like, that's something, yeah. I think you'll notice down the streets. If you don't know somebody, you're going to make a quick look and then look back to the ground or whatever. But when you know somebody, you start to hold eye contact longer. And it's very obvious to people who aren't getting it. Yeah. Like, it's really, and I'm just like, well, then that's like, I'm trying to telepathically say, well, then come to office hours.
Yeah.
Right. Like, office hours are really important. And sometimes they don't, they're not, I guess they're not telepathic.
You can think really hard. I'm just laughing because I know I was sitting in that tutorial last week and I had the most bewildered look on my face. I was like, you were like, some people in here look confused. I'm like, it's me. I look confused.
Yeah. And you were almost hidden behind a post. So yeah.
Yeah.
I think sometimes you have to also, sometimes we'll, one person, I like, is everything okay? I checked in with them once. They're like, oh, I just forgot my contacts, or I made my glasses at home. And so they were squinting the entire time. I was like, well, you can come to the front, right? Like, yeah. But just the, because that look is the same look of just like, you know, complete confusion.
Yeah. I've been told I have an expressive face as well sometimes. Yeah. So yeah, it can be a giveaway.
And I mouth stuff to myself too. And then people think I have the answer, but I don't have the answer. I'm just saying something to myself to try and work through it in my brain. I'm very,
thought bubbles.
Yeah. And so a lot of the time, I didn't realize I did it for so long. And then someone pointed out, they're like, you talk to yourself a lot. And I was like, oh no.
Sometimes
I've been doing that out loud. I've been making it be seen.
When I'm caught talking to myself, I just say I needed an expert opinion. Yeah. That's all it was. But I have myself taught at several institutions in the GTA, and it is nothing personal. This negative mindset, the stigma with organic chemistry, I see it again and again and again. But the idea of the weekly quizzes is great. And as you said, it's not just for students, it's for us as well as instructors, because then we're getting feedback on what's coming across and what students are having challenges with. So I find that helpful as well, even incorporating polling questions in lectures and, oh, we didn't understand that concept. Let's flip back a few slides.
Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for undergraduate students who have experienced failure, and how do you recommend they respond to it?
Yeah, I think I've said this to your class. I don't know if you remember it. I say a lot of random things. But I think, you know, I said earlier, embrace failure. I don't think everyone can do that because they're not in a comfortable place with their families that we talked about before. But I do think, and this is me, again, a bit of a privileged thing to say, but you have to, I don't like that word confidence. So never do I like to people to say, oh, just be more confident or blah, blah. Because it's not, confidence is an attitude. So it's not a skill. So it's not one of the transferable skills, but perseverance is. And I think at any level, like some people see getting a B on an assessment as a failure in their mind, right? It's like, that's not where they're at if they're an A+ student. Yep. So I think it's to persevere through your insecurities, right? Like ask yourself, why does that make you feel insecure? Because fear is just an insecurity, right? At some, and failure is just a realized fear. You got to just persevere through those things. And I think that's easy to say because I've got lots of opportunities where I've done it. Right. And I don't think anyone can, you know, you'll always be scared of like zip lining until you do it.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and so that comes back to the embracing the failure thing. Like don't let this be the thing that defines you, because in the future, there aren't going to be assessments or tests. So how do you assess failure then? Like, My biggest failure is actually in my personal life. Those are the bigger failures in life that you're going to experience. It's not in the classroom.
No, yeah.
So what are you going to do in those moments to rise above? What are you going to learn from those moments? And how are you going to persevere through them? Yeah. Because that, I think, shows greater character, and it also is a much better learning lesson in the end. And those are real failures, not these other ones that are artificial and academic.
Sure, absolutely. Always contextualizing the failure and putting it into perspective, because in that moment, it can feel huge. But at the end of the day, it's a drop in the bucket.
Truly.
That perspective taking is actually a really good add-on to that, too. I think it's really important because that, you know, at least I'm not a duck, right? That feeling that I had when I don't like to, you don't have to project onto other things to see this, but that perspective taking was really important, because I have certain things that I can do that certain things can't, right? And just be grateful. And I think maybe that's the best thing to do when you're try to find those things that you're really grateful for and reflect on those in comparison to these failures.
Yeah. Because at least you can comprehend that there's a glass wall there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's funny because I'm looking at a board that's also made of glass, and it kind of feels like you're talking about that glass wall.
But I really appreciate you bringing up the privilege of being able to fail, especially with my research and always sharing with students the value of failing as part of the learning process. Again, it's so simple for me to stand at the front of the room and say that, but at the end of the day, the consequences of failure are not experienced the same way by all students. A classic example is retaking a course. Some students can retake a course, it's no problem. Others aren't in a financial position where that's even a consideration or an option for them. So I think that's always really important to consider when
think about why you need to retake that course too, right? Like that, there's another aspect here too. Sure. That it's like sometimes failure guides you to what you're really good at.
That's true. That's very true.
Actually, I would argue all the time. Now, you don't see it in the beginning, but it guides you to something that you're good at.
Yeah. I didn't fail. I got a D in Calc 1, but I knew that I couldn't move on to Calc 2 without retaking Calc 1, because I knew that if I had just gone straight ahead, I would have just created this landslide situation. And I really did. I took the time to go through and be like, what did I fail at? What or where did I come up short? Then I ended up doing really well in the course. And I think I'm secretly actually okay at math, which I never knew was going to be a thing. But I took the time to learn. And honestly, if you had asked me 10 years ago, would I say I'm good at math? I never would say it. But now I'm here. Yeah. Now I'm here and I'm enjoying it.
So. Look at that growth mindset.
Look at that growth. Look at her go.
Brian, thank you so much for your time today. We've taken a lot of your time today. It's been a wonderful conversation. But at the end of every episode, we like to invite our guests to advertise whatever you wish. Current projects, research opportunities, anything you would like to highlight for an undergraduate focused audience?
Yeah, so reach out, go to office hours, talk to your professors, they're human, and ask them questions that are curious. I think that's what, because for example, I would never take a student who I did not know in my research group. Like we have to have some sort of similar perspective of the world in order for me to want to be mentoring you. And grades don't matter, but that perspective matters, like your transferable skills matter. And so I have to have interacted with you in the classroom for me to even suggest that. So talk to us. I think that's the one weird thing. Like office hours, at least for me, used to be out like such a long lineup, and no one's coming anymore. Like, and I think that might be just cultural style thing, or maybe people aren't spending as much time on campus as they used to. Whatever the reason is, I'm here if you have questions, and it doesn't just have to be about organic chemistry. It can be about anything, including research opportunities. And I think a lot of my peers would welcome that in office hours too, as opposed to answering the same question over and over again. So I think that would be the advice I would give for students to put themselves out there and be a human. Talk to other humans. Enjoy it. Learn from them.
That's so foreign. All right, amazing. Thank you so much once again, Brian, for coming. And look forward to seeing you tomorrow in class.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And that is a wrap on another episode of Mistakes, Missteps, and Mindsets. We hope you enjoyed. As always, we would like to extend our thank yous to Toronto Metropolitan University for hosting us, the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council for making this podcast a reality, as well as Kyle Andrews for putting together our wonderful theme music. Most importantly, we would like to thank you guys for listening, and I can't wait for you to come fail with us again next week. See you then. Bye.